Joel Caselli, longtime associate of director Ang Lee and author of Making of the Life of Pi, will be on hand for a special talk and book signing event on February 9th from 5:30 to 7 o'clock in Saugerties, being held at the Fiberplane Studio. Life of Pi, directed by Lee, who spent time in Woodstock for his last film, has garnered 11 Academy Award nominations. The name of the book is The Making of Life of Pi, a film, a journey, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Joel Caselli to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
No problem. My pleasure.
It seems as though it would be a very exciting time seeing this film get so much recognition and so much really genuine emotion.
Yeah, it was certainly a long time in the making. We started in 2009, so it's been a long trip, and it's very gratifying. I mean, it was a very risky project. I started off by working on the film, and then I ended up writing a book on the film. So I kind of have seen it both from the inside and the outside, and it's kind of an interesting position. But it's just great. Yeah, people really respond to it very emotionally, and it's touched a lot of people. I mean, that sounds awfully corny, obviously, but it's true.
When you were working on it, did you realize, I mean, obviously the source material has a lot to it. There's a lot of meat to it. And you realize that there's a lot to work with. But I assume it became very clear very soon that this was something that was delicate.
Yeah, from the beginning, because it's... it's a story that hinges on ideas, on ideas about faith, storytelling, and the meaning of life, and so on. And these are at the same time, it's also a very big kind of motion picture by its nature. And how do you make something of that size with the whole kind of complement of special effects and so forth, and at the same time, not lose, use all of that at the service of something that's essentially, I guess jokingly, it's kind of a huge budget independent film, because ultimately it's a very intimate story about one individual, and it's a film of ideas to some degree, so it's kind of an odd hybrid in that sense, I think.
How much discussion was there at the very beginning regarding 3D?
3D came in pretty early on. I think what really convinced Ang was there was a test that they did of just, filming water in 3D and with a 3D camera, and that really brought this incredible life to sort of the image of the water surface. And water, people always talk about, Pi and the tiger, Richard Parker, but really the sky and the water are also characters in the movie as well. And, there's a kind of conception that one has of 3D that it's either, something that pokes out of the screen or something that kind of draws you into the screen, which is kind of what Avatar did for the most part. But, with Pi, there's a whole sort of range of uses of 3D. It becomes kind of part of the cinematic vocabulary. And it's not always obvious because there's no closed room. There are no necessarily fixed points of reference a lot of the time. So it's kind of a subtle effect. But what it really does, among other things, is it brings the water to life and it brings the ocean to life. And I think that was the first thing that really... as far as I know, convinced Ang that this was something that had to be part of the equation.
You have a section in the book quite a bit about working with four tigers and a hyena. That's an interesting cast choice, obviously, of having to deal with that.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about the movie is that, in any given scene, let's say the tiger is just kind of wandering out around a boat or sort of lunging at Pi or whatever, it'll cut back and forth between footage of a real tiger one of the tigers that was used in the filming, and a digital tiger. And the reason for using the real tigers, I think, was basically to raise the bar, to make sure that there would be, you know, sort of an absolute realism, so that when they had to switch to a digital tiger, that everything, you know, both, you know, in the sort of macro level of behaviors and gestures, and also just in the micro level of, you know, the way, you know, the paws flex and the ruffle of the wind on the fur and all that would be absolutely realistic and indistinguishable, you know. So there's a real kind of seamless quality between whether it's a real tiger or not a real tiger, you know, to the point where, you know, I mean, I've seen both sets of footage and I kind of forget which is which, really. It's pretty remarkable the work that they've done, you know, that they did on that.
You spoke about the water a moment ago, but I just want to go back to it because this was the largest wave tank in the history of film.
Yeah, was it the largest? I don't remember.
Well, it says that on the book, so I'm only going by that.
There may be sort of larger ones. I think it's the largest one in terms of the largest wave-generating tank. I think there are larger tanks that have been used for filming. I'm not sure. You know, I'm kind of misremembering here. But in any event, it was certainly the most sophisticated in terms of the range of effects that it could generate, because one of the things that, you know, is mentioned in the book that they wanted to avoid was the bathtub effect. I mean, the problem with wave tanks is that it generates a wave, and then, you know, anybody who's been to a water park knows this, the wave splashes against the side, and then it kind of comes back.
Right.
And so even when you have, you know, sort of a nice digital overlay on that effect, you know, you will have a storm scene in the middle of the ocean, and it's kind of subtle, but still there's a sense, there is a kind of bathtub sense of the water sloshing back and forth. And so this wave tank, I mean, the two special things was, one, you know, there was a very sophisticated machinery to calibrate different kinds of ocean, you know, sort of mid-ocean swells, you know, of all different levels. And then the second thing was that they put these tetrapods, which are these kind of concrete thingies that are used for, you know, absorbing high tides and things like that by engineers, at the end of the pool to absorb precisely the water so that it wouldn't sort of come rushing back. So, but everything was done, you know, and Aang, you know, even though Aang is not an engineer or an ocean person, he sort of obsessively was very much involved in every single detail of, you know, continuously calibrating and adjusting the tank for the use in the film. And the funny thing is also, you know, one of the interesting thing is that in terms of the two scenes that really don't use the wave tank at all, pretty much, are the two big storm scenes, because those, you know, require waves that can only be, you know, generated in this kind of digital manner. In that case, you know, what's very interesting there is that there's a sort of balance between, on the one hand, still, you know, this kind of absolute realism. It has to, you know, Aang wanted it to be both, you know, waves that were completely, you know, that could be these big storm waves, but at the same time, they were choreographed. So that was a huge challenge for the special effects people who worked on those scenes. And, you know, again, it's just remarkable. I mean, there's just billions of droplets of water per frame. You know, the amount of computing that went into it was massive. And so both the sort of physical waves and then the sort of virtual waves, you know, again, huge amount of work. And you know, all of this, you know, digital stuff, the special effects, the 3D, I mean, the cameras were huge and so on, but, you know, it all disappears. That's the beauty of the movie. It all kind of vanishes, and one is absorbed in this movie and in the reality of the movie. It's all at the service of the story.
When you see a film like this get 11 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture and including for Best Director, I assume everybody just sort of beams in pride from that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, we're all thrilled. I mean, obviously there's stiff competition out there, and, you know, there's always the politics politics and the guessing games of, you know, why didn't why didn't Catherine Bigelow get nominated for this, or why, you know, all this stuff. I mean, it's all talk. So who knows? But you know, we're just thrilled, and certainly, you know, I mean, I hesitate to make predictions, but I'd be really surprised if it didn't get a lot of great sort of below the line, you know, effects Academy Awards. I mean, it already won, you know, for the wonderful score that Michael Dana did in the Golden Globes. And, you know, I think we've got a pretty good shot at taking home a bunch of awards. And, you know, we'll see which ones. But
again, you can find out more, and it's a wonderful event, a Q&A event and book signing with Jean Castelli, Saturday, February 9th, 5:30 to 7 at Fiber Flame Studio in Saugerties. And you can find out more information about the event by going to woodstockfilmfestival.com. woodstockfilmfestival.com. Jean Castelli, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Well, thanks so much. It was a great pleasure for me.
Enjoy the event. Again, Jean Castelli at Fiber Flame Studio in Saugerties, Saturday, February 9th, 5:30 to 7, in an event presented by the Woodstock Film Festival and the Golden Notebook. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.